Texas is big enough to have two time zones and several distinct topographies, balmy beaches, plains, high desert, and piney woods. Usually this means a wide variety of local weather forecasts around the state. But in mid-February of last year came an enormous prolonged Arctic blast that brought ice, snow, and sustained single-digit temperatures to parts of the state that rarely see lows below freezing. With heaters going nonstop in virtually every corner of Texas, power providers would have been challenged regardless. But their own operations were also affected by the weather, forcing shutdowns and blackouts that left millions of Texans in the dark and cold for days. Those of us who lived through it understood we could not let this happen again. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. A few weeks out from the first anniversary of that freeze, we wanted to know how much progress Texas has made toward protecting us from a similar disaster, or at least from the man-made components of it. Mose Buschel is here to tell us what he's learned. He is a reporter for KUT and host of the podcast The Disconnect, Power, Politics, and the Texas Blackout. Mose, welcome back to Think.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Will you start by giving us a quick rundown of why things went haywire in this state last February?
Well, I thought you did a great job kind of setting it up for me, but to get into a little more detail, it really was a question of the supply of energy plummeting right as demand skyrocketed. And the obviously demand was going up because of that cold. Everyone needed energy to try to stay warm, and supply was dropping. Because the things that give us energy, power generators and our natural gas supply, were failing in the freeze. What happens when that supply and demand get out of whack is that the people that operate the electric grid in the state, ERCOT, a name that we're all pretty familiar with by now, they need to rebalance that supply and demand on the grid. If they don't rebalance it, the entire grid can kind of just break down, and we can have a situation where we have no access to electricity, possibly for weeks, kind of an absolute, almost nearly apocalyptic type scenario. So what ERCOT did back last February was began cutting power to millions and millions of people sounds like almost a desperate effort to maintain that balance on the grid. That's what we lived through, that's what we went through last February. Some of us did not live through it. Some of us did not survive it. But that's what happened last February. And that is what we've been trying to correct in our energy system ever since in the state of Texas.
And we skated really close to, you alluded to this, a catastrophic failure that might have left the state without power for months.
Absolutely. I mean, what happens when they can't keep supply and demand balance on the grid is that it starts to actually kind of fry individual components of the grid. Things literally break down, and then the various power plants that are all interconnected along transmission lines, feeding energy to people, to factories, to everything else all around the state. Those various components of the grid literally start pulling apart, disassociating from the grid in a desperate effort to not allow themselves to be damaged by the grid's breakdown. And when that happens, it's often kind of referred to as a catastrophic grid failure. You need to restart the grid almost like just bit by bit. You start a little power generation going in one part of the state, try to start feeding it along the lines again, and slowly relight that fire to kind of spread throughout the state again. It can take, by some estimates, it can take weeks. And what's even more frightening is that what we found out last February is that the system that we have in place in order to restart the grid, if that were to happen, is called a black start, was not up to the task. Some of the various energy generators that we have in the state that are supposed to be on hand in order to restart our grid in this worst case scenario, they too were broken down. They would not have been available to save us from this. So as bad as things were, and I'm not trying to downplay how bad they were horrible. That was the worst case scenario that we were confronting during that freeze last February.
Okay, we'll get to weatherizing or winterizing in a moment, but we should note that lots of other states have very extreme weather. Some have been caught off guard by unseasonable temperatures and blackouts. What makes the power grid in Texas so different from those other places that caused so many millions of us to be without power for days?
So the one thing that you'll notice right off the bat is that we're talking about the power grid in Texas. We nowhere else in this country do people have these conversations about their state's power grid. That's because other states are interconnected regionally across the country. Texas is the only state that maintains its own sovereign independent power grid that supplies electricity to about, I believe, 90% of the population of the state. We have really minimal interconnections with other power grids around the country. And the reason for that is because to increase interconnections would bring more federal regulation over our grid. And up until now, it's been the decision of policymakers and others in the state to want to maintain that independence in order to avoid that regulation. So there you go. That's one answer. There are other things that are also really unique about our grid and the way that we generate electricity here. You know, a lot of our power is because we have our own grid. It's the fuel that we get also primarily just comes straight from within our state. Whether we're generating electricity from the sun and the wind that we have in Texas, or as the largest fuel source that we have from the natural gas that comes out of the ground here in the state, all of that comes from Texas and is turned into electricity in Texas to then bring power to Texans and to big manufacturers, to individual residents, to everybody who's using electricity in the state.
All right. It's not necessarily a bad thing that we have the capacity to generate a whole lot of our own energy. What is this talk recently about some kind of strategic natural gas reserve for the state?
Well, I mean, this goes back to what happened in February, because to understand the failure in February, we need to understand how vital our natural gas supply is to electricity generation. It wasn't just power plants that broke down in this freeze. It was the fuel that so many of them require to generate electricity. And in the months, in this almost like you said, a year since the freeze, it's become clearer and clearer that failures along the natural gas supply chain led to this catastrophic event. It wasn't the only thing. There were problems at generators too, but it was a major component in what we went through. So some people are now looking at this and they're saying, well, one thing that might help correct this is if we had more natural gas supply on hand to bring to power plants. I suppose that would be one of the arguments in favor of such a project.
Do you know exactly what's required practically to make that happen? I mean, how easy is it to store a whole lot of excess natural gas?
I'm really not sure what the answer to that is. And there is, I mean, there are already like massive natural gas storage, facilities around the state. What you found in February was that some companies which had stockpiled natural gas supply and were able to sell it at a premium during that blackout made a ton and ton of money. So if you had a stable natural gas supply that you could get out at that top dollar price, you were making billions of dollars. So it's not, technically storing natural gas in large quantities is not something that's unheard of. Obviously, we have a strategic petroleum reserve that we, national that we have here in Texas that we keep in Texas.
Okay, at the very least, we know we cannot allow our power plants to freeze up in large numbers again. In practice, what does it mean to winterize or weatherize a power plant? And how different is the process for, say, wind and solar generated power as compared with coal or gas?
That's a really good question. I have visited a power plant to watch them winterize, and what it kind of came down to for me as I was taking this tour is that there are like the and this I should say, you asked about different types of jet power generators. This was again a natural gas power plant, and so there are different kind of ingredients that go into the process to make electricity out of this kind of power plant. One obviously is natural gas. Another is air. It's kind of interesting to learn to just how important clean, dry air is to the kind of operations, turning the different components along the power plant. You need this air to be running through pipes, and you need it to be, like as I said, dry. If there's any water in there and it freezes, the whole thing can break down. So you have natural gas, you have air, and then of course you also have water, and another thing that can freeze really easily. If any of these ingredients, as I said, freeze up, well, you're in big trouble. So winterizing a power plant means insulating it. It means running heaters along important parts of it in order to keep those ingredients from freezing. It means putting up shelters and windbreaks around all the different computer panels and mechanical components that could freeze in a heavy, windy winter storm. One of the main challenges in Texas, though, is that our power plants here are not designed for the cold. They're designed for the heat. They're actually built outside, often way in open air, right? Like they want to get in the dead of summer, they want to get as much heat off of these things as they can. So winterizing requires them to take something that's made for summer use and then put all these other things on it as the weather begins to cool so that they can keep operating in the winter. What's different, and I don't want to ramble on too much, but what's different between that and other aspects of the energy supply? When you're talking about natural gas wells and the natural gas supply chain, you're sometimes talking about wells way out in the middle of the oil field that could be difficult to get to in icy weather. You need to consider how to keep those things warm. There are other heating components they have for natural gas wells that are sometimes powered by electricity, sometimes also powered by natural gas. And then there are also things you can add into the natural gas supply to keep the water and other components along the way from freezing, like other kind of chemicals you can put in essentially to lower the risk of freeze-offs from the wellhead through the pipeline to the compressor stations, what have you. These were all problems that we saw in February.
Are these changes, whatever might be required, are they very expensive for power providers relative to the amount of revenue they receive?
Yeah, I mean, this has been one of the big kind of questions about the way we run the energy market in Texas, right? When you talk to power plant owners, they talk about an energy market where the margins are so thin, their interest is in trying to turn a profit, and they're basically the market incentive has been to cut any corner you can cut in order to stay competitive, right? That would be their kind of excuse for not taking these measures voluntarily. Likewise, in the state's natural gas market, you could see the same kind of market dynamics at play, although it's a little different in terms of natural gas. We can get into that later. So yes, the cost has been probably a barrier to some of these companies, and that goes to our very unique competitive energy market in Texas, which is something another way that we are different from the country, and is something else that regulators have been now kind of overhauling, I guess you could say, trying to change in order to increase electric reliability in the state.
Yeah, I mean, you and I have talked about this before, but it bears going back into for folks who missed that conversation. Deregulation in Texas meant more competition, potentially cheaper rates for customers, but economic efficiency and electric reliability are not the same thing.
No, and it's interesting, in the aftermath of the February blackout, last February blackout, right? Like you suddenly had people at very high positions of government saying as much stuff that you never heard them say, essentially ever since we deregulated about 20 years ago, that we had essentially sacrificed reliability for cheaper electricity. And the changes that the Public Utility Commission, which is the state agency that oversees electricity, the electric grid in the state and electric utilities, the changes that they're trying to do are very, it is incredibly kind of mystifyingly complicated stuff that has to do with changing the way that electricity is bought and sold on this grid, creating new financial mechanisms and incentives to try to put more energy online on the grid when we need it. And all of these are underway now at the Public Utility Commission. Right before Christmas, they seemed to have approved one part of their proposed changes to the energy market. They're going to get an update on that mid-January this month, and then there'll be more coming down the line in the coming months. But there's still a lot of questions about what As I said, it's almost like creating new financial instruments and mechanisms to incentivize power. But there are a lot of people that say that there's just really been no cost-benefit analysis. It's not really clear to many how this might help. And the one thing that does seem clear that you know you'll even hear public utility commissioners say publicly is that it will cost more, right? You know, the cost of electricity is going to go up as a result of this overhaul. And obviously people would want that to also ensure more reliability if that's the case.
We should note this is not, it's not that electricity providers in Texas have never thought about winterizing. They've been thinking about these things and working, in some cases, working on winterizing efforts for some time. Why has it taken so long for many of them to say the process is complete?
Well, I mean, again, it really goes back to that financial incentive, I think, in a lot of ways. We had a major winter storm in 2011 that should have been our wake-up call, right? 2011, we had a huge freeze and we had a blackout. And the reasons that led to that blackout were more or less the same that led to our experience last year. The state legislature convened and created some new rules around winterization, but didn't create any real enforcement or teeth or mandates for winterization. And what we saw was that it was not sufficient. Again, I mean, I can only point back to the kind of market incentive. If you're not, if your goal is to be as run as cheap as you can, and there's no one telling you that you've got to clean up your act, and it's going to cost you money to clean up your act, well, you might not do it.
All right, so Governor Abbott has promised we will have no such failures this winter. I have to say, so far, it's been an unusually warm winter throughout much of the state. How much power does the governor of Texas, any governor of Texas, actually have to deliver on such a promise?
I mean, I think it is it's I don't know of anybody who could actually, you know, realistically make such a promise because nobody knows what the weather is going to be like, and nobody knows what, you know, every eventuality of every possible thing that could possibly go wrong. But what the governor has done is clearly applied a lot of pressure, both publicly and behind the scenes. And there's been some good reporting on this that's out there to kind of bolster people's confidence in the grid. So you had the governor saying the lights are going to stay on. Again, like I don't know how you can really make that promise. It doesn't seem possible. And then you had the chair of the Public Utility Commission saying the same thing. You know, the governor can apply the pressure that he can apply. But when you talk to analysts, when you talk to energy experts, they say that many of the same problems that existed before last February still exist today. And if you look at reports that have come out from federal regulators, from the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, when you look at ERCOT's own seasonal assessment, readiness assessment, all of these things say the same thing, which is essentially, you know, if we had extreme cold weather, we could see more blackouts. It's extreme cold weather, you know, like we had last February, doesn't happen every year in Texas. So it's not to say that it's likely we're going to have a blackout this year, but it's also not fair to say that the problems have been solved, that the problems that were revealed in last February's blackout have all been solved. Everybody I talk to, you know, kind of is clear-eyed about this, seems to say they have not.
What was in Senate Bill 3?
Senate Bill 3 was a kind of omnibus bill that looked to answer a lot of the kind of key problems that were identified after last February. And so it didn't just tackle things like we've been talking about with winterization and the kind of infrastructure part of this. It also looked at communications issues, for example. That's another place where there has been some movement, right? Like just making sure that people are informed about a potential energy emergency earlier and better. And it also spoke to some of the market redesign that they thought would have to happen in order to incentivize that reliability that you mentioned over low cost electricity, I guess you could say. And so it was a lot of things, and some of those things have moved faster than others. Another thing that's in there was plan to map our energy infrastructure, basically supply chain mapping. There's just a report out just this week from the committee that was formed to do that on their progress. So they're looking at the electric supply in the state from the very source to right to the end user, and trying to figure out where you really need to kind of harden things to ensure that they're ready for bad weather.
In the immediate aftermath of the disaster, some people were getting these exorbitant bills for energy, thousands of dollars for whatever they used over the course of just a couple of days. What's the status on changing the potential for that to happen again?
That's a great question. Yeah, that really caught headlines right after the blackout. Those types of retail electricity programs have been essentially banned since the blackout. That was another component of the legislative reform that happened. Basically, those plans pegged individual consumers' electric bills to the kind of spot market for electricity. So the way the electric market in Texas works, again, is just supply and demand. If there's very little supply, the prices can go up way super high, and residential consumers were on the hook for that if they had those types of plans. Like Gritty was the one that was best known. But I think that there weren't a ton of people that had those plans, right? And if you consider all of the people in Texas, what's important to remember is that even for people that had regular retail electric plans, that whether it was from a rural co-op, a private retailer in deregulated parts of the state, or from a municipally owned utility, those bills are going to go up because of the massive debt that was incurred during the storm. And this is another thing that happened after the blackout, is that lawmakers actually created these financial structures that where we can pay off all this debt that was owed that's owed because of the storm in small installments. And those are already hitting our power bills and our gas bills. Last fall, the Railroad Commission approved securitization. Sorry, that's basically approved measures that will pay off about $3.4 billion of money owed to gas companies because of the high price that where gas went during the storm. So it wasn't just those. It wasn't just your Gritties and your other kind of Wild West retail electric plans that increased people's bills. Those were the ones where people's bills went crazy. But everyone is going to see higher bills as a result of the storm.
I have really mixed feelings about this, Mose. My neighbor just invested in a generator, and although I'm glad to know that there will be one, within a few houses if
Yeah,
I have
yeah.
to power something up,
Absolutely.
Not everybody can afford this. Even the cheap ones are a lot, for families who were struggling just to pay their bills as it was. It doesn't feel right to say, well, you're on your own if something else goes wrong. On the other hand, not being prepared, it doesn't mean that nothing bad will happen.
No, and I mean, in a way, you're seeing this kind of two-tiered system being created of people's like comfort with the grid breaking down, right? If you have the resources, maybe you can feel more secure, knowing that you'll get through it. But most people don't. In fact, there was a woman who spoke at the Public Utility Commission last month who said as much, who said, during the next blackout, is it going to be the poor or the homeless, or maybe not even just low income, but and people who can't afford these kind of added measures to protect themselves, they're going to be literally left out in the cold while others can stay warm. It's something I think we all need to think about because the idea of having a shared electric grid is that it protects us all, and so that should be the end goal. At the end of the day, obviously people want to protect themselves and their families too, but it's important not to lose sight of that shared goal.
All right, I don't want to end this conversation, Mose, without talking about accountability. On the one hand, when something goes wrong, sometimes it just feels really good to have someone to point the finger at to blame. But ultimately, the point of accountability is ensuring that mistakes don't get made twice. Who is accountable to us for fixing these problems and ensuring that in the future we are as well prepared as we can be to weather natural disasters affected by human-made systems?
I mean, yeah, at the end of the day, it's our elected leadership, right? We have regulators in place that have authority over these private concerns, you know, your power companies and what have you, that are given that authority to protect the general population. And I'll go back to the example of 2011. After the 2011 freeze, there were measures put in place that were supposed to protect us. Clearly, they did not. And so I remember in the course of doing interviews after the blackout, one person I talked to said, you know, markets aren't, if we're talking about the energy market in the state, it's not like markets exist just out of the blue. They're created by people, and those people are our state leadership. And so they need to, no matter what kind of market you're talking about, it's up to them to create one that ensures electric reliability in most cases. I guess the only other thing to think about is, like, you know, at what point do you, in the debate right now, really that's happening, is at what point up do you plan to, right? Right now, the state grid operator, ERCOT, is not even planning to prepare for another freeze like we had in February. That's not the benchmark they're looking at. Is that wise? Shouldn't we be looking to make sure that we can do better if we get another freeze of that magnitude? Or was that such a kind of out of the blue, once in a lifetime event that they don't even need to look at it, which appears to be the approach that they're taking? These are all questions that I'm asking right now, that a lot of people are asking right now.
Well, I'm glad you pointed to elected leaders as where the buck ought to stop, because I think a lot of those leaders are happy to point the finger at ERCOT and the PUC as if they have sort of no relationship between who serves on those agencies and how they do their business.
I mean, it was like, yeah, it was like one of those games where you put, after the blackout, where you put like a penny or a bean under three cups and you start, you know, like shifting it around in the table. It's like, where is the responsibility? Where's the responsibility? These things have seemed so kind of fragmented that you forget that there's actually a system of authority that can come in and take charge. And it also, that becomes even more muddied when you consider all of these private interests, you know, private companies acting in this market. Everybody starts pointing the finger at everybody else. But at the end of the day, you know, our elected leaders are the ones that write the laws, that make the rules, that appoint the regulators, and that have final authority. And so that is, I think, an important takeaway from all this.
Quickly, before I let you go, are we in good shape for the coming summer that's just a few months out?
That's a really good question, because the second you start thinking too much about one thing, and it's the other thing, right, that comes up and gets you, right? All of the assessments that have come out that I've seen, long-term assessments, you know, suggest that we're probably okay unless something really big happens. And that's basically all they generally say when they come out with these assessments. So we have an electric capacity, kind of a cushion of extra energy beyond what they think will be our peak use that should get us through a hot summer day. But again, things can go wrong. We are living in a time of really extreme weather events. And so when you take a super extreme weather and you combine it with an electric grid that is perhaps not in the best shape it could be, you can't help but be a little concerned.
Journalist Mose Bushell is a reporter for KUT, host of the podcast The Disconnect, Power, Politics, and the Texas Blackout. Mose, I always learn a lot talking with you. Thanks for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. If you'd like to subscribe to our podcast, it's free where you get your podcast. You just have to search for KERA Think. You can also listen anytime at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.